What makes something popular, be it a movie or a song or a politician? That's the subject of a new book by Atlantic senior editor Derek Thompson. It's called Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. Derek, great to have you.
It's great to be here.
And did you find out, as you were doing the research for this book, what makes something popular?
So the book Hitmakers has two theses, which I think I can summarize in seven words. Familiarity beats novelty, and distribution beats content. So what does that mean? Familiarity beats novelty. We want to like new things, new songs, new movies. But what most of us gravitate toward are familiar surprises, new products and ideas that remind us of old products and ideas. The second thesis, distribution beats content. We also want to think that the best songs and shows and ideas will inevitably become the most popular. But the most interesting and the most important story of a new product is the story of how it got to audiences. Without distribution, a great product is doomed to oblivion, no matter how wonderful.
Well, let's go through some of the examples that you get to in here, because they're very interesting and they really span pop culture and politics and all kinds of things. You write about somebody named Raymond Loewy, who was remarkably good at predicting what would be popular. And he had a theory called MAYA, most advanced yet acceptable. What does that mean?
Raymond Loewy might be the most significant commercial artist of the 20th century, and it's ludicrous, really, how few people know his name. He was the Steve Jobs before Steve Jobs. This man and his firm designed the Exxon logo, the Lucky Strike pack, the Greyhound bus, the modern tractor, oven, refrigerator, vacuum cleaner. So how in the world did he know what all these people wanted? His theory, as you said, was MAYA, most advanced yet acceptable. He said people are torn between two forces, neophobia, a fear of new things, and neophilia, a desire to consume new ideas and products. And he said, if you want to sell something familiar, you have to make it a little bit surprising. But to sell something surprising, you have to make it a little bit familiar.
And to that point, you point out in this book that in movies, in 15 of the last 16 years, the highest grossing movie in the U.S. has been a sequel. So maybe something surprising, but also familiar.
Sequels, reboots, comic book universe extensions. And I brought this up with one film executive who said, you know, people say TV is in a golden age and the movies are obsessed with sequels. But you know what a television show is? It's an hour of entertainment followed by a bunch of sequels. Hmm. So new episodes of familiar conflicts turns out to be what audiences want from just about everything.
Speaking of movies, you point to an example in this book of something that became a hit, but it didn't become a hit at first. It became a hit after it was associated with a movie. This is the 1954 song by Bill Haley and his Comets. This is Rock Around the Clock.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're going to rock around the clock tonight.
Okay, so everybody knows this song, and they know now that it was a hit, but it wasn't a hit at first. What happened?
It's the number one rock and roll song of all time. It's the second best-selling single in music history. I don't know how you can listen to it without tapping your foot. But when the song came out in 1954, it was a B-side, and a lot of people didn't tap their foot. It was mostly ignored. And here, this is the crazy, wonderful story of Rock Around the Clock. One of the few people who buys this song is a fifth-grade boy named Peter Ford. Peter is the son of a movie star, Glenn Ford, who appears in the 1955 movie Blackboard Jungle. And Glenn Ford, the movie star, is having drinks with the film's director. And the director says, you know, by the way, I need a jump jive tune for this film. Do you have any ideas? And Glenn Ford goes, well, my son, Peter, give the director some of your favorite music. And lo and behold, this 9-year-old boy hands the director Rock Around the Clock. The song plays at the beginning of Blackboard Jungle, in the middle of Blackboard Jungle, at the end of Blackboard Jungle, and only then, a few weeks after the movie comes out, does it become the number one song in America, the first rock and roll song to ever hit number one on Billboard.
And your point here is that it's not the quality of the song that made it a hit, because if it had been, it would have become a hit at the very beginning. So what was it? Why did people like it the second time around?
This goes right to the second thesis of the book. Content is less important than distribution. You have the same song come out in two different mediums, two different ways. One, in 1954, it comes out and it's kind of a flop. 12 months later, it comes out and it is the top-selling song of the decade, the second best-selling song in the history of rock and roll. So what is the actual quality of the song? You can't say. What matters is distribution and exposure.
We're speaking with Derek Thompson of The Atlantic, whose new book is called Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. And Derek, on the point that you were just talking about, you also bring up the example of impressionist art. And some people may disagree with this part of it, because you make the point that a lot of the famous artwork that we know today is famous because a particular person in France decided to make it available to the public to see.
That's right. So as everybody knows, the Impressionists were widely ignored in the mid to late 19th century, and today they're among the most popular painters in the world. What happened? Well, an incredible number of the most famous Impressionist paintings come from one collection belonging to a lesser-known Impressionist named Gustave Caillebotte. Gustave Caillebotte dies early in his 40s, in the early 1890s. He bequeaths his entire collection to the Musée du Luxembourg. Essentially, the Musée de Luxembourg takes his collection, and when they hang it, it is the first time ever that Impressionist art has the imprimatur of the French government saying, yes, we are allowing this to hang in a public museum. So that generation's art historians write about those paintings, and the next generation's art historians read those generation's art historians about those paintings. And so the power of this initial moment of exposure snowballs such that these random paintings that Caillebotte collected turns out to be paintings that we can't help but see. They're absolutely everywhere. One of his paintings by Renoir, Bal du Golem de la Galette, was discarded. Nobody would buy it. Gustave Caillebotte only bought it because he wanted to be nice to his friend Renoir. In the late 20th century, this painting sold for more than $90 million to be the second most expensive painting in the history of art. So the same art pieces that were absolutely ghastly from the perspective of an 1870s art historian are now considered absolute classics 140 years later.
And to the person who listens to you say that and says, well, they are brilliant pieces of art.
If they're brilliant pieces of art, they should be as brilliant in 1870 as they are in 1970 and 2016. But the fact is they're not. And we see this as a story of culture across pop culture categories, that there are all sorts of ideas like Impressionism or the last one I mentioned, rock and roll, that are scandal, scandal, scandal. And then they have this moment of public consecration. And after that, they become culture.
One more category we have to go into, especially when we're talking about how things become popular, is politics, because these are people, politicians, who are trying to get popular support for themselves and for their ideas. And you get into that in this book and bring up some of the rhetorical tricks that politicians have used in the past. Tell us about those.
Yeah, musicologists have shown that repetition is the God particle of music. You can take essentially any sound, even the sound of a human voice, and start repeating it again, start repeating it again, start repeating it again, and the brain will suddenly just begin to hear that cacophony as music. Da-da-da-da-da-dun, da-da-da-da-da-dun. So repetition has this powerful, amazing trick of turning cacophony into music. It's also true of speech, of political rhetoric. Basically, every single example of Greek high political rhetoric is a form of repetition. There's anaphora, which is repetition at the beginning of a sentence. Winston Churchill, we shall fight them on the beaches. We shall fight them on the landing grounds.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields.
There's tricolon, which is repetition in short triplicate. Abraham Lincoln, government of the people, by the people, for the people. There's diacopy, which is repetition of a word or phrase with a brief interruption, like FDR. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Or an ABA structure. Sarah Palin, drill, baby, drill.
We will drill here and drill now, and now's when you chant drill, baby, drill. Yes.
And then there's the most famous example of repetition in rhetoric. It's called antimetabole. If you don't remember that word, just remember A, B, B, A. Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Or Hillary Clinton. Human rights are women's rights, and women's rights are human rights.
Human rights are women's rights, and women's rights are human rights, once and for all.
And that resonates because we hear it and it sounds musical to us?
Yes, that's exactly right. It works because the brain processes the music first and wants to fall in love with the music. And so we allow sometimes questionable political ideas to just flow by because they're presented in beautiful and musical ways. So this is both, yes, a trick, but also something for audiences to watch out for, because it is a way for politicians to turn any terrible idea into music.
Derek Thompson, his new book is called Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. A lot of fascinating stuff in there. You can read an excerpt at hereandnow.org. Derek, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.